Hello and welcome to another episode of the Creative Weirdos Podcast. I hope you all have been doing wonderfully. This week we have the pleasure of talking with my good friend Jason from the Esoteric Book Club about more comics weirdness. I am so excited with how this conversation came out. Jason brought a bunch of new topics around sequential art that I haven't got to talk, mainly some of the early 90s to mid 90s boom with artists like Jim Lee and the collapse of the comics industry in general. We talk about early weird digital coloring to beautiful comics that stand up through the test of time and all kinds of other wonderful weird stuff. So please enjoy this conversation and go check out all of Jason's work linked below, including his beautiful show, The Esoteric Book Club. That's all I got. If you want more, check out the Patreon for me linked below and have a great day. I'll talk to you soon. Bye. Thank you so much for coming back and joining me to talk comic books today. I am very excited. I think this is the fourth episode in of the comic book series that I'm doing, and I don't know how long it's going to go or anything like that, but it's really got me kind of reinvigorated with the show in general, and I'm excited to have back some past guests as yourself and talk about comic books. And when we started to set this up, you brought up two people that I am super interested in, Andy Kubert and Jim Lee. And I'd love for you to just kind of dive in and talk about why you brought those two up.
Well, I was a kid in the 90s, so I primarily saw those two through the X-Men comics. And because of the X-Men cartoon especially, you know, that reintroduced the series to really everybody. It was this bold reimagining. It was an updated modern retelling of the story. And the comic style was very much based on Jim Lee's illustrations. If I remember correctly, the reboot that they did for the comic series, he headlined that, I believe.
I think so.
But looking back, I didn't realize how much Andy Kubert really was the illustrator that I was emulating.
Yes.
And the two, at the time, it was hard to tell the two apart because they have very similar art styles, especially if you're, you know, middle school, high school kid. It's hard to differentiate between the two. But looking back, it seems like Andy's art was, again, like we said before the show started, it had this sketchy feel to it.
Yeah.
And it was very much based on motion, and camera angle was a huge one with him too. I actually have one of the X-Men comics I had as a kid hanging up on my wall right now. And it's this bizarre cover from the Omega Red story arc. And it's almost like a 3/4 top-down view. And it's just Omega Red just laying waste to the entire X-Men team, just piling through them. But because of the tendrils that this guy has, there's so much motion. And Andy has used that motion that's naturally formed by these tendrils moving. And he's positioned all the characters in a way that it just constantly causes your vision to swirl on the cover.
Yeah, that's so cool. And I love that you start with the emulating these artists, because that's exactly how so many people enter creating art for the first time, is by copying these different comics. And like, I think, again, we were talking before the show started, and I was saying I came to comic book art and comic books in general later in life, closer to my junior year, senior year in high school, where I was really looking to, I knew I wanted to be a full-time artist, and I knew I'd always loved like comic strips like Calvin and Hobbes and Peanuts and stuff all the way through high school. And I started getting interested in telling stories visually. And one of the things that you do or that you look for when you're going for those kind of reference materials to copy and to redraw is you look for compositions that have like full figures and things that you can actually like render completely. And that era of artists, Jim Lee and Andy, like they offer that so much where like you open the pages and it's not like, you know, a lot of comics or sequential art where it's a half cut off face and like somebody facing the back and like, but they give you these beautiful full page figures. And one of the things that Andy Kubert I think represents in that kind of sketchiness you referenced is there's an approachability to the art. Like you realize, like once you start drawing them, how hard it is, but how none of it's as accurate as you think it is. And it kind of gives you that little bit of like, oh, maybe I can do this. Where if you look at things that were like, you know, I know this is a way different type of comic, but if you look at like the EC artists of like Johnny Craig and Wally Wood and these guys, you're like, oh, I can't do that. Like, I can't, like, you know, there's no way I can get there. But your Jim Lees and your McFarlanes and these guys from the 90s, they were so stylized and so over the top, it became approachable in certain ways. Was that something that you kind of resonated with their artwork?
Yes and no. You actually brought up Calvin and Hobbes and like the Far Side, and I just realized now that I owned all of those books, but at no time did I try to illustrate in that style.
Yeah. Interesting.
I never went for the cartoon style, and I don't know why. I loved reading it.
Yeah.
But I never tried to emulate that. I also went from drawing dinosaurs and dragons to drawing comic book superheroes. So, you know, that's a logical transition in the theme of things. But so stepping back, like Jim Lee gets a lot of flack currently for his X-Men being super buff, like every single one, every muscle is defined, and like the women were super curvy and everything. But as a reference for someone who's learning to draw the human figure, that's actually really helpful.
Yeah.
So once you learn that you can draw all of these things and you're able to put these on a figure to show the definition, then you can step back and say, okay, well, where would you not see this because of a clothing fold or because of the way the fabric stretches? And it's actually really liberating to go backwards and take that step back after you've become or started focusing so much on the detail.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Figure drawing is one of those, like, it's like the hidden history of art. Like, figure drawing is just at the core of everything. And like, you know, when I started getting like formally trained, when I went to art school and all, like figure drawing is such a big part of it. And it's something that I think most, you know, students or younger kids like rebel against. Like, they're just kind of like, nope, don't. Because, and a lot of the times I think it is because it might be the hardest thing to do. It might be the like hardest thing to actually like master as far as technical, like the craft of drawing or the craft of rendering, but the comics make it approachable. And I think you're like, the way that you just explained that is something I'd never thought about before, but makes a ton of sense. And like in certain ways, I'm sure is, it can form some bad habits if not done properly. You know, like sometimes
for sure,
like,
yeah,
people don't go those steps back like you were talking about, and they just stick with the super busty, ridiculous. There's definitely some of that has stuck around. That like, and again, it makes sense in comics because comics are exaggeration. Like, that's the other thing I love about that 90s era. And again, we were talking before the pod, aesthetically, it's just not my favorite type of comic art. Like, it is just not the thing that I look at as far as, ooh, that's beautiful. You know, like there is something really special to it, but it redefined a language within sequential arts, which was super interesting to me. I think there's been these little pockets of time where there's these giant shifts in the aesthetics applied to comics, like Jack Kirby coming in and completely redefining essentially the 70s through the 80s. And then some, like the 90s, are kind of that next big, like, oh, this is a completely different style. We're not worried as much about storytelling anymore as we are about just making giant, like, flamboyant images. Like, we just want these to be as bombastic as possible. And that is kind of like, it just goes along with the 90s extreme culture. Like, it fits in so well with everything else from commercials that you would see on the 90s TV shows to the X Games coming out, and that whole, like, everything neon and in your face that was those, like, early to mid 90s culture that I remember fondly. And I love that comics played such a big role in it. And I was wondering, since you were reading these as in the 90s that came out, what was it like? Cause I was not into comics at that point in my childhood, but, like, what was it like going to the shop and buying these books on a weekly basis and being a part of that kind of cultural movement?
Well, first of all, I lived in the middle of nowhere on a farm. So going into town weekly was not happening.
That didn't work. Okay. Yeah. That makes
no,
a lot of sense.
No. I got to go to the comic shop maybe about once a month. And, well, you know, at the time, they still had newsstands in grocery stores and drugstores. So I was talking about this with my family the other day. I remember there was this, it was a small CVS before they got really big chain stores, right? It was a tiny, tiny shop, but they had a fantastic newsstand, and they had so many comics. And the only time we went there is when we had to pick up medication when someone was sick. So I remember that even though I may have, you know, been horribly ill and needed medication, I could go to the CVS and look through all the comics.
I love it.
And I remember X-Men, not because of the cartoon specifically, but because it was so different from other popular comics. By this time, you know, in the 90s, everything was Batman because of the movies. And it had started upping the camp in the movies, but in the comics, it started getting super dark. It was a weird, weird back and forth. But, like, the X-Men, there were some issues where there wasn't any action. And it was such a drama compared to the other superhero comics that were on the market at the time.
Yeah.
And as a kid, you don't realize when you're reading this, you're like, man, there's something really special about this and something that I resonate with, but I don't know what it is. So I couldn't put my finger on it. And then it realized, you know, later on in life, I realized that it's that othering. It's that sense that you're not like the other people, and something you really have to find other individuals that you connect with for the same reason.
That's beautiful. Absolutely. I think X-Men is such a good allegory for that, and definitely one of the, I mean, it was the hot book at that time. That's the thing that was always so funny that I think so many people don't have a reference point to, is that, like, all the big Marvel characters that came about recently with the movies, or not came about, but, like, gained popularity with the movies, they were, like, the garbage books. They were the you know, like, they were the books that, like, no one really cared about at all at that point. Like, X-Men were the top set. Like, that was one of the big books.
Yeah.
And I think that's super interesting, the fact that you brought up the newsstands and how comics got out to more rural areas and how the access points became different once it went from that newsstand model to just a comic book, the direct market in the comic book shops, and how, you know, that I think about that era a lot because I love these kind of upheavals of creative markets that go on throughout history, right? And that was one of the big ones where comics stopped being sold purposefully or only at newsstands, and this whole other model came, not only in, like, the comic book retailer, but the way that the comics are distributed and the way that these distribution companies like Diamond work, and how, you know, certain publishers only went with certain distributors and certain books wouldn't even end up in certain states or certain, like, giant areas because of the way this all fluctuated. And that probably really affected people more in a rural area like you were growing up in once that transition happened. Then I never really thought about that before. It's super interesting.
Yeah. So, like, on the newsstand, we primarily had the big name Marvel titles. We had several DC, and believe it or not, because of the area, super conservative area, Topps Comics.
Oh, wow.
Like the people that made the trading cards, they had a comic series. So you could get like Archie and Sonic the Hedgehog and some of the Disney titles. And they would do a lot of movie tie-ins. So like they did an X-Files miniseries. They did a Jurassic Park miniseries. So those things were readily available at the newsstands. But if you wanted something that wasn't the mainstream, you had to go to a specialty shop.
Yeah.
So I remember going to one of our only, I think it was the only comic shop we had at the time, to get Magic the Gathering comics.
Amazing. Amazing.
And now that I think about it, that's actually very similar to one of the other themes I was bringing to the show, because Magic the Gathering at the time, we think of it now and it's kind of like this gothic noir, but it's very bright colors, lots of saturation. It's really over the top, very computerized graphics. But at the time I was playing, you know, this is like the third edition, the revised edition. This is when it first came out, when it first started becoming mainstream. The illustrations were dark.
Yeah,
they were moody. You know, you got a feeling and a theme from these cards, and that translated into the comics. Yeah. And they had this magical, sketchy style to the line work, and they had a themed color palette. And it wasn't always from comic to comic that it translated. Like if the topic changed, or the subject, or the location even changed, the color would change with it, and so would the color or the pencils. So you got this really unique feeling of being a planeswalker from Magic the Gathering, because every time it changed settings, everything changed.
Yeah.
And it was really, really cool how they could do that in the comics.
That's so interesting. I never looked at, there's so many comics that I've never looked at, but the Magic comics are definitely ones that I need to. I was in that same era. I remember getting Magic the Gathering cards for the, you know, I don't know if it was the second or third but series, but it was early on in there. And like the artwork, they felt like full oil paintings. Like I don't know what the actual illustration methods were, but they felt like they were like, you know, fully rendered paintings. And there is something that's interesting about that transition from kind of genre, like comics do this so well. I mean, you started the whole conversation with it with the X-Men cartoon, but there's something interesting how these characters and properties can kind of transition mediums, and comics allow for that so easily, and they really bring something special to the table. Like the fact that like even something like Magic the Gathering that is a card game can come through and create a, you know, very substantial work of sequential art is super interesting to me. And when it goes the other way around, when comics go from just being comic books to animated shows to movies and everything else, I think there's something that is special when these fictionalized stories or characters kind of break out of the mediums that they start in and expand. And I feel like comics are always this kind of link or this web that help that along.
For sure, for sure. And they also define their own styles and mediums. Because think about Bruce Timm, how iconic his art style has become. It's definitely an extension of like Mike Mignola style art.
100%. Yeah.
But they're also very different based on, again, the color palettes.
You're so right. You're so right. And I love those little hidden fingerprints. I was listening. Are you familiar with Carl Barks? He did all of the like classic Scrooge McDuck and Donald Duck comics back in the day. He invented Scrooge McDuck, and he invented like pretty much all of the nephews, all of the side characters that are in the Duck that are not Donald, essentially. He invented all those characters, right? And he did these comics that are probably some of the best comics out there. Like there's a lot of problematic content in there, and like stuff that does not age well as far as depictions of other cultures and things, but like as far as just somebody creating a, it's one dude doing everything except for the coloring pretty much, and he is creating these giant mythologies, and he was known as the good duck artist because you would get these you would get these Disney comics, and it would be like a Carl Barks feature story that would be like 8 pages long, and then there would be like 2 or 3 like Chippendale or Mickey Mouse backup stories by other artists, and no one ever cared about those. They always wanted the duck stories, and it was always because, but no one knew who Carl Barks was because he had to sign Walt Disney. Like, it was all ghosted, right? So forever they just called him the good duck artist because they knew that it wasn't Walt Disney, but no one knew who this guy was, right? So he creates this giant body of work. These comics, when they come out and hit the newsstands at the time, they're selling millions and millions of copies, like some of the most widely distributed comics in the history of the art form, and they make it internationally, essentially, right? So you think about a lot of the times right now how much manga and anime has influenced American comics, and like how much like we've brought that, like that is American comics almost at this point, as far as if you walk into like a Barnes and Noble, there's like 9 shelves of their titles and maybe 2 little like, you know, actual American comics, right? But one of the things that I heard this expert from Carl Barks talk about is how after the bombs were dropped, right, in Japan, when they got essentially packages to be like, sorry, we blew everything up, comic books were in there, right? Like, and they were these Carl Barks comics, and people like Otomo fell in love with these comics. And he, I mean, you know, one of the most legendary creators in the sequential art form for sure. And he has credited in interviews the large eyes in manga coming from the Barks comics, coming from Donald Duck. Those Disney eyes influenced manga, and then that came back and influenced, you know, it's just so funny to see the reissuing of influences and how like this dude that like was drawing Donald Duck essentially influenced one of the creators of one of the most adult versions of comics out there. And like, you know, like I love those hidden fingerprints, and I feel like comics has a million stories like that.
Yeah, it's this interesting feedback loop, and it's one iconic genre or style influencing another, which influences another, it influences another creator. Another child out there somewhere is going to learn how to draw from this, and they're going to create their own style, and here in like 20 years we're going to have this new iconic art form that is influenced, say, on like, I don't know, Ren and Stimpy.
absolutely. No, that cycle is so like, I think about this a lot with my own work and like my own weird place in creating stuff, right? And I'm way less concerned about ever leaving behind like a masterpiece or like any kind of like big influential work, and just way into the idea that I'm just a part of it. Like, I'm just a part of that recycling and like, you know, that kind of big circular influential cycle. And I think that's all you can really hope to be. And if something bigger comes from that, that's awesome. But I think about that a lot, and it makes me, I don't know, it makes me feel better about the things in my life sometimes.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So one of the things that I wanted definitely to touch on with you, because, and you already brought it up slightly, is the coloring. And we talked about a few things you wanted to bring up on the show here, and how important coloring is to comics, and how it's kind of one of the unsung heroes of the whole medium, and how much like from working in the limited means and palettes that you could work because of the printing reproduction capabilities in the first like superhero comics, to the modern day like full painted Alex Ross or watercolor comics. Like, I think there's so much to be said about how the color is used. And you brought up a couple examples that I'd love for you to dive into.
Well, let's talk about X-Men for the first part, because like you mentioned, the 90s, you saw this really big resurgence of using color, and for better or worse, you know, the 90s, they were bright, you know, neon colors. We could reproduce things hyper-saturated for the first time on page, and they tended to use that to full extent, whether they should or not.
Yes.
And then we even saw in some of the X-Men comics, we saw some of the first graphic computer graphic coloration. I actually remember seeing that for the first time, and it was such a mind-blowing experience, going from what you could tell was ink-based coloring to something that was computer digitally colored for the first time. And it just had this, the range of color was so different and it was so unique, but there, it hit the uncanny valley.
Yeah.
It didn't look right. And there was an awkward period in time where people were still learning how to actually use computer graphic software to do coloring. And it was weird.
Yeah.
It was super weird, which works great if you're doing a sci-fi comic. But if you're doing something like Captain America and you're using the Uncanny Valley coloration, it's not going to work out well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely, that 90s era of coloring was so interesting. One, it's like anything else. It's like when CGI first really became available in those early movies and you're like, oh yeah, that didn't work out too good. But you got to take those swings, right? Like that's how you progress. That's how you get the technology to where it is. But I think there's also like these, again, these are all preferences and everything, but when I look at a modern colored comic book right now, I think there's these leftover things that happened from the 90s that I'm still just aren't really the aesthetic that I'm into, because they, for the first time, had the ability to not only use these like super saturated colors and all these like really bright neons like you were talking about, but they also could kind of like try their hand at realistically rendering these things and using more of a realistic palette. And I think that led to a lot of like just very murky comics. Like they were trying to do in a lot of instances what seems like these full paintings without learning how painting actually works, because they just could start with because one of the things that you'll notice, one of the reasons I think some of this is so murky, and other people who are smarter than me have said the same thing, is they're using black in all of their other colors. Like when they want a shadow, they'll do they'll use black to like add to make a darker red instead of adding some purple to that red, or instead of adding a little bit of green to that red. Because when you're painting, you never really use black as a value. You use it very sparingly. When you're trying to create deep shadows and stuff, you're usually using purples and reds and contrasting colors and things like that. I don't think that knowledge was really a base for most of these people coloring comics in the 90s. I think they were just like, they had this new tool. They had never like fully colored things like that. And they were just, this needs to be darker. Obviously it just needs to be a little bit like 16% K, you know, like we'll just get that there and it'll be a little darker. But when it prints, it gets all muddy because it's still underneath a ink layer, and the blacks kind of fight for your attention in the whole thing. And I think one of the things that was always, let me think. One of the things that resonates with me about a lot of art forms is working with limitations. And one of the things that I've always loved about comics is it was this art form that started out as not only a very commercial art form, where they were very upfront that this is about getting books on the stands, selling books and making money. This was not like a very like, you know, a very high heady art form to begin with, right? And I kind of love that about it. The other thing was that it was a black line reproduction. Like it was meant to be printed kind of shittily and kind of quickly and kind of cheaply. And like they only had four colors to work with, and they made the most out of those four colors. And when you look at some of the beautiful forms that took, I don't think we would have got there, or we would have had those works in the same form if they started with the same tool set, if that makes sense. And I kind of love the limitations pull out the beauty in things. And when those limitations get peeled back, it kind of changes the whole medium, because now, one, the printing changed. So it's no longer black line reproduction. Color printing is as affordable as black and white printing. And like, there's no reason that we should even be using black lines in comic books anymore, to be honest. It's like my favorite comics these days usually have a different shade of finalized ink or trap layer. Like one of my favorite artists right now, Tom Scioli, if you look at the books he's done recently, that one of his most recent ones is a biography on Stan Lee, and there's no black in it. It's all like a dark brown is the ink trap line, because it's, and it looks beautiful and it looks so much more pleasing with all the colors. So I think like there's this like big revolution that happens, but it takes so long for the actual artwork to catch up with the technological advances in certain areas. And I think comics are still getting there. I think we're still like in the process of being like, oh shit, it's a printing revolution. And like not to mention things like Procreate and all these other tools that have come along since the 90s that make full coloring so much easier and everything else. I think we're still kind of catching up with it all, and I'm excited to see where it all goes.
I think one of the coolest uses of technology that I've seen in reference to black line work is that a lot of times they're desaturating it.
Yeah.
Or they're blurring it. So it's not so crisp. It doesn't have that, I guess, the comic book style.
Yeah.
But it still defines an edge. It's got just totally. That little bit of color there. And it really emulates the shading of pencils. And I love that.
No,
especially if they
it.
Leave some of the pencil work in there.
Yes.
And you get that sketchy edge on there. Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
And it really harkens back to when they were doing intensive ink work for shadows instead of just adding a blob of color.
Yes, absolutely. It's Tom Scioli, who I mentioned, also only works in pencil. Like, he started with the Jack Kirby biography. He drew the whole thing in digital pencil because Jack Kirby, he's a penciler, so why not use the tool that the dude used? And from there, he realized how much more pleasing it is to the eye with the amount of colors going on to use the pencil line instead of a harsh ink line, to use that soft lead. And you really get that texture and that warmth that you can only really get from there. And you're right. It does harken back towards that, like, essentially getting it all practical and getting it on in the ink and getting in. I mean, when you look at the amount of different textures that can be defined in ink from somebody like a Bernie Wrightson or a Wally Wood, where, like, on one page they'll have like tree bark, metal, leather, and, like, you know, a shirt fabric, and it all looks like it should, but it's all just black and white and it's all just textured. And it's like, man, that is an art form that doesn't exist in the most comics these days, but it does. It can be brought back by utilizing these new tools in that way. And I think that's what it comes down to, is your goal as a creator. Like, if you want to work in the language, the classic language of comics, right? The heavy inks and the heavy black lines and everything, then to me, it makes more sense to keep the colors in that, like, kind of four color CMYK. You get your little bit of each one, that classic comic palette, right? That works really well. But if you want to go for these full rendered, much more modern comics, then yeah, like, you got to take back that black line, unharshen it, like, soften it a little bit. And you got to, like, be able to, I think the other thing is the white page that a lot of these people will talk about. If you look at, like, what's so pleasing about the newsprint comics, it's that yellowing of the page, and, like, it gives the colors a base. Like, most paintings, when you look at an oil painting or someone, the process of someone's painting, it doesn't start on a white canvas. The first thing they do is prime the canvas with a darker color to pull shadows, to pull lights out, to push shadows in. It's very rarely a white surface that painters are working off of. And I think comics, now that we have these full color capabilities, the harsh white page can fight against that. So again, just like rethinking comics in general. And I, you know, I'm not the first person to say this. This is stuff that's covered on Cartoonist Kayfabe all the time, and, like, Tom Scioli and all these other people that are much smarter and better artists than I am, right? Like, I've resonated with what they said, and I've applied a lot of it to my own drawings and found that it's definitely more pleasing to me. So it is interesting how I love how technology forces creative shifts and market shifts, honestly.
Well, we're also seeing people being able to play with the technology more now too, because for a long time it was cost prohibitive.
Yeah.
But now that it's more accessible, we're getting people who can experiment and really play with the art style. So we get unique things where, well, like we were talking about earlier, limiting the color palette for your story.
Yeah.
It was done not... I mean, previously it was done because of limitations of the technology, right? You could only print four colors, so that's what you had to work with. But then you get people like Mike Mignola, or even, not Eric Larson. I'm blanking. Kevin Eastman and Laird. I forget his first name.
I'm sorry.
The Ninja Turtles.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Eastman and Laird. Yeah. What is Kevin and, man, now I'm forgetting.
Is it Peter?
Peter Laird. I'm almost positive you're right. Yes. Absolutely.
Well, think about that. It was all ink work plus red.
Yes, absolutely. Again, borrowed from a huge chunk of manga. Like when you look at how that's reproduced, it's usually with one red spot color, and it's colored pages almost always. Like when you go through the go through the novellas of it all, there's usually like different colored pages that kind of separate different chapters and different like feelings and everything. And like that, those are things that like, man, it goes so far. It really does when you use those very small, limited. I think of zines a lot too. Like when I grew up zines, and like those one spot color print zines that are either on risograph or like just silk screened, or even just like the old mimeograph style. Like those are just so beautiful and thing aesthetics that I feel like hold up. That's the other thing that I think is interesting about these choices when you're working on this. Like, when you see a Jim Lee or anything from the 90s, you go, ooh, ouch, 90s. Like, you know, like whether it's good or bad, you're just like, that's the 90s. Like, that's what that is. When I see like a black and white Wally Wood piece, I don't know what time that is. Like, you know, like I do because I know it's like Wally Wood and I'm familiar. But if I was coming to this, I'd just be like, whoa, that could be created today. That could be created, you know, 300 years ago. I don't know, but that's something that seems more timeless when like you're adding these new technologies and things like that. That's where like it takes a minute, because sometimes like you're defined by that aesthetic of the technology at the time, if that makes sense. So I think you're almost like safer working in that limited palette as far as creating something that stands the test of time or is a little less tied to a period.
Well, to quote Jurassic Park, you know, you were so occupied with whether you could, you didn't think whether you should. And that's a terrible, terrible paraphrasing of that. But, you know, the point remains, yes, you can create neon pink in full vibrancy, full saturation, and you can create these radioactive greens, which I'm a fan of, but, you know, still, it doesn't have to be in every comic. Mm-hmm. So being able and a lot of times the capabilities of creating these colors, people get so occupied and wrapped up in that they don't stop and think how to create mood using those colors. And again, it's that limited color palette or even just a different way of coloring. One of the examples I brought with me is, and I hope I'm saying his name correctly, Greg Tocchini. He was the colorist for a short-lived comic called Low. Now, this is a futuristic sci-fi that takes place underwater. The sun goes red nova. We can't live on the surface. So all these hab domes were created underwater.
So
and
cool.
What Greg brings to this is that he works in watercolor.
Oh, wow.
So you get this full sense of the aquatic feeling of growing up and living underwater.
That's amazing.
And the colors blend, they bleed, and it's really you feel like you're watching all of this through a glass panel of a helmet or through the wall of the hab dome or something like that. It's very thematic.
That's so sweet. I've never read that, but I need to look it up now and check it out, because that's beautiful. And I love purposeful colors like that. I'm trying to see, because it's going to bug me, but what it makes me think of right off the bat with the watercolors is Superman for All Seasons, which is a Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale retelling of the Superman origin story, essentially. Like they did a bunch of those in the 90s and late 90s, 2000s, like Spider-Man Blue and Hulk Gray and all these other ones. But Superman for All Seasons was a retelling of the Superman origin story, and it was all done in watercolor. Like it was Tim Sale art with watercolor, and I was trying to see who colored it, because I'm not sure if I don't think it was Tim Sale. I think it was somebody else, but I'm not coming up with it real fast. But it's beautiful watercolors. And I remember reading an interview with Jeff Loeb, and he said it's because, you know, it's all set in this rural town and the small farm town, and he wanted it to be like a Norman Rockwell painting. He wanted it to have that Americana feel. So like they were very very purposeful in the way that everything's rendered. And it's just so beautiful. And it makes the whole story. It really does, because it's all light and fluffy and just like, I don't know. It's just one of the first thing that came to mind. I have to check out Low. I've never seen that, but now I have a new one on the list. And the other colorist you brought up before the show was Dave Stewart. And I love that because he's one of my favorite. I think there's too many amazing. I just did a quick Google when you brought him up earlier, and I was like, oh, he colored all of my favorite comics ever. That's why I love him.
Yeah.
But he just has that like perfect palette for the classic comics. Like, he keeps it a lot of the times, he keeps it in that kind of primaries and those very like that mood emphasizing palette, like less of the worrying about whether the grass is green or the sky is blue, and leaning into the pink skies to give you that like a twilight feeling, or the dark purples to give you that really midnighty feeling. And like, I just love that because it makes so much sense and seems so obvious, but it's also something that it seems to be implemented not too often these days. But yeah, what connects with Dave Stewart's work with you?
Well, it's funny that you bring up how he creates these really bright colors and everything, because what brought me to him was actually through the Dark Horse Conan series, where everything was an ochre color.
Whoa, that's
so
cool.
It was a very naturalistic, earth-based, very primal feeling, and it was a color palette that matched the theme. So when you saw a vibrant red or a vibrant orange, you knew it was fire. You knew something was magical going on. Something big was happening.
Yes.
And he really used those pops of color against a very dark, muted background to signify action on the page.
Oh, yeah. I just looked at some of them. They're gorgeous. Wow.
And you pair really him cool. with Kerry Nord's line work, which, again, it's very sketchy, but it's also very organic. So, again, you get that very primal, very earthy tone and feel to everything about it.
And it's
which
so...
is perfect for Conan.
Yeah. No, I'm looking at a few pages just real quick on... And it's... And this is what I think is so different about comic coloring when it's done right, is it's like lush, and it's like it's one of those things where it seems like there's way more going on, but when you look at it, it's very simple and very defined.
Yeah.
And like, man, yeah, that's beautiful. Another one to add to the list. Conan is one of those books where like, or one of those titles that I've looked at a million different, you know, comics. I've read so little Conan. And like, I've just ogled over the artwork of people like Barry Windsor Smith and all these amazing artists that have worked on the title over the years, and like so much cool stuff, but I need to catch up on the actual reading of it for sure.
What I really appreciated about the Dark Horse run on Conan is that they based it on Howard's work.
Oh, that's awesome.
In fact, issue zero was an illustrated version of the Conan poem.
Oh, so cool.
Yeah.
That's
and it's
really
a very
awesome.
Minimalist poem. So there's like a single line per page, but then there's a splash page.
Yeah.
And it shows something that's going on in the world related to that line.
That's
and it's
so
just
cool.
So beautiful. It's a small, small comic. You know, it's only maybe a dozen pages. But even the cover, I'm looking at it right here on my wall. Again, the motion, the lines, the colors, it all works together so well to it's evocative. That is the best way to describe it.
That's awesome. So with comics in general, like obviously this is something that's meant a lot to you for a long time. And are you still reading? Like, do you still keep up with the current comics from Marvel, DC, or what's your current reading habits like?
I haven't picked any up recently, but really Image Comics is the way I go for the most part. I'm not really into the superhero comics anymore, and that's mostly because of the writing, especially X-Men. I was not a fan of the direction they went with it recently. It probably has something to do with the parent company that now owns Marvel. But, you know, when they stepped away from X-Men being an allegory.
Yeah.
And especially now, there is so many opportunities for them to embrace that with the X-Men And they could, and when comics are using or being used as allegory, those create some of the best stories for us.
Yes.
100%. There's a reason Superman is so popular still, because he is the ultimate immigrant.
Yep.
He embodies the American spirit. Think of Marvel Civil War. That was such a fantastic story arc in the comics, not the movie. The movie was, I don't want to say it's hot garbage, but it wasn't good. It did not in any way capture the feeling or the mood or even the themes of the comic.
Yeah.
But like I said, when it's used as allegory, those are when we get the best stories. So instead, I go to Image Comics, who really, they support independent comic creators. Yeah. It's really just people who have a story that they want to tell. They work with artists to tell that story, and they have creative control over it.
Totally.
And that's one of the best things. You don't have a governing body telling you, oh, well, you can't have Captain America do this because that doesn't seem in character. Well, if he's your character, you can have him do whatever you want.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, that's a great, great point. I mean, I honestly don't keep up with any current, like, I read a lot of comics this year, but none of them, very few of them were actually made this year. Most of them are either me catching up on, there's so much in the way of modern underground comics or alternative comics or independent comics, whatever you want to call them. There's so much out there that is gorgeous and just like things that, I mean, I don't have enough time to read everything I want to read in that regard. So I try and pick and choose here and there, but very few and far between are the superhero books that I read these days that were made before the 80s. I usually, but it's the type of thing that I'm interested in. And I ask everybody, because I still have a couple friends that go to the shop every Wednesday and have their books they like. They follow the writers they like and the artists they like more than titles, you know. But they definitely keep up with it, and they'll somewhat defend things out there, but for the most part, they know that a lot of it is hot garbage and not worth the time and everything. But it is the type of thing that I'm so out of, I don't even really know what's going on anymore. So I always like to ask people if they're up on it. But I think the real good stuff is exactly like what you said. I mean, to me, like, the best comics, and one of the magic parts about comics is it's usually one person sitting down with a story and executing that story without any outside influence, because it's one of the only mediums that you can sit down and not have to work with 30 other people to accomplish it. It can just be you and a pencil and a piece of paper at a table, and you can make the whole thing. And there's something special about that. Like, there's something just as special about the collaborative process that it takes for, like, making movies or cartoons or TV shows, or something that's, you know, inherently magic in these combination of pure personalities and creative imaginations and everything. But there's also something really special about the singular voice that you can find through comics. And the ones that really do it for me, the ones that I tend to go back to time and time again, are like Daniel Clowes, for example. Like, written, drawn, inked, colored, everything, one person, one artist's view. And like, those are the books that I tend to pull back off the shelf year after year. And most storytelling, there's so much more that goes into it, and so many more unseen hands involved. And I think it's interesting that comics still allow for you to tell stories from a singular voice.
I think that's why so many web comics have really just been so wildly popular lately.
Yeah.
They're not the easiest thing to find. It's very difficult to find new voices and new comics. But when something when it lands hard, and it just takes off. Yeah. And it goes back to that, what you were just saying. It's one person. It's one vision. It's one story. And it feels alive.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it. That's a great way. So do you still draw? Are you still making comics as far as drawing and things like, or not even making comics, but do you still get into that side of things? You started off, or we started this whole conversation talking about how you would, you know, draw Andy Kubert pages or Jim Lee pages. Is this something you still are currently taking some time to do?
Yeah, I still draw quite a bit. Most of it's sketching, but recently for a class I'm teaching on animal tracking of all things, we were trying to figure out at the school how to make that appeal to kids more. So I came up with the idea of theming the entire class around Pokemon.
It's beautiful.
So what if you were trying to play Pokemon, but with real animals? How would you go about that? What would your achievements look like? So I drew out all these icons for different things in the game. So there's different icons for different terrain types. So that's a real challenge in itself. It's like, how do you represent an entire ecosystem in a single 2x2 square?
Yeah, right.
And then the easiest one was the food type. What do they eat? Are they carnivores, herbivores, omnivores, insectivores? Those are fairly easy. You know, you can draw those pretty literally. But then, like, how do you represent the senses of an animal?
Yes.
Especially when they're so varied.
Yeah.
So, like, what I ended up doing is for the ones that have the best sight, I used a bobcat's eye or a rabbit's ear or a fox's nose. So the very minimalist way to convey a single concept into these icons.
Yeah.
And that, then the kids will get, they'll get stamps in their book every time they find some evidence of this animal. So like when they find the track of a specific animal, they'll get a stamp. When they find the scat of the animal and can positively identify it with that animal, they get a stamp for that. The most fun part that I have in this class is setting up the trail cameras. So they put out lures for these animals, specific animals, and it preys on the animals' habitat, their behavior patterns and their favorite foods, and also on their most primary senses. So their goal ultimately is to get a photo of that animal.
That's so awesome.
I do a lot of illustration for the role-playing games that I run. I'll have to send it to you. I just ran a game campaign last semester called The Shadow of the Broken Moon.
Love it.
Yeah, so it was this world where there originally were two moons. A meteor or an asteroid, it would have to be an asteroid, hit one of the two moons, and it just rained destruction on the land. But the remaining rock is now orbiting the remaining moon.
Amazing.
So you have this Saturn-like thing in the sky at all times.
Wow, I love that. That sounds so good. And you do illustrations for all of this. You got to send me those. I want to see them.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's so cool.
But again, it's limited because it's all black and white.
Absolutely. And what you were just describing with the Pokemon symbols, or the idea of that, like, reduction to a simplification of just like the pure essence of something visually, that is comics. And that's one of those like magical things in comics that I think people take for granted because it's been around and a part of our language and visual language for so long. But like, think about the first time that like I think about like the sweat coming off the brows for someone being nervous, or like these little visual shorthands for all these things that we just take for granted that we know what is. Think about the first time someone drew that and was like, "Ooh, this represents that," or the first time somebody just did like a little dot and was like, "Oop, that's the eyeball." Like, I think about that all the time. These polka dot eyes, how you can reduce like the most complex thing in the human body almost to this little dot that represents it, and it's more effective. And I love the idea that Scott McCloud covers in Understanding Comics, where the whole point of this reduction and the simplification is to make it more universal so that it's easily read and just incredibly understandable. And like, those are the comics that I think, again, really nail it when they can kind of take that simplification and enhance your reading experience and the interaction you have with the comic and your imagination using these symbols. Because you have to, like, it's not like a book where someone's describing something to you and you're just picturing the whole thing in your head. You're getting a starting point, and then you're kind of adding on to that based on these visual keys that you're given. So it's like engaging your imagination in a different way. And I think that whole playing with language is all part of that. And it all comes down to exactly what you're talking about, simplifying things to symbols and like, how can I make this understandable and easy and read in this little tiny panel and not have to fuss over it too much.
Well, that's just it with comics and really all art. It doesn't matter how literal you can get with it. It's all still symbolic.
Yeah.
You could get this photorealistic oil painting and it's still just a symbol for what that thing actually is.
Yes, absolutely. No, that's the abstractions is to, get into a slightly more esoteric conversation. Like that abstraction, I think, is like the whole kind of meat of the creative process, is taking in this kind of everyday life and reimagining it and putting it out into, whether it's comics or paintings or whatever it is. It is that abstraction of what we see around us combined with the kind of bringing things up from the subconscious. Or, I talk about it a lot with like Kirby, who has all of these very esoteric themes throughout his life, throughout his work and everything. And I don't think they were very intentional. I think the dude was just drawing and writing 6 pages of comics a day, and that stuff just bubbled up and like came out of him, and you can kind of tell when you listen to him talk about it. These aren't like fully formed ideas that he has. These are just things that come and he has to do and he has to create. But it's not like he has this like, blackboard outline of this mythology and everything. It's just like these things just pop in his head and they come out, and that's how, it happens. So I think it's this perfect combination of those two things that can be very important, or can create very important works of art.
Kirby was so good at taking intangible concepts and visualizing them. Like we especially saw that in the Doctor Strange comics.
Absolutely. And he created languages for those things. Him and Ditko both created these like how do you represent mysticism, and how do you represent, the cosmos? Right. How do you draw these things? And they figured out this brand new language to represent them that is still used to this day. Like if you want to draw a cosmic abyss, there's going to be some Kirby crackle in there. There's going to be like those things. And like, I think that's like some of the most interesting points in comics history is, again, it's those fingerprints. It's like they influence pop culture in ways they never intended to, or couldn't have foreseen in their lifetime.
And we're even seeing that with science now, where the stuff that Kirby created back in the 70s, they're now shifting, say, the cosmic photos from the Hubble telescope. They're doing a color shift, so it looks like what we expect.
Yeah.
It has these purples and pinks and greens. It has the nebulas that are really just gas. You can't really see it, but they do a color shift so we can interpret it how we expect it to be, which is based on Kirby's illustrations.
Wow. That was mind blown there. I never thought about that, but you're absolutely right. That's so beautiful. That would make Jack happy.
and we're hitting that feedback loop that we talked about earlier. Art is influencing reality, and then reality is turning around and influencing art for the next generation. And it just goes in that cycle over and over and over again.
It really all goes back to this idea that I've been thinking about a lot recently and listening to a lot of smarter people talk about, as far as just that the basis of everything is not material. It is the imagination. It is mental. Mm-hmm. Like the basis of everything, I've been reading some Neville Goddard, and, the imagination is God in his books. Like that is how he frames the whole thing, that like everything is from and of the imagination. And it's kind of the same idea as a lot of different people I've been listening to talk about things like idealism and stuff have. And it's very interesting to me. There's this dude, Bernardo Kastrup, that I've been listening to a lot. And the way that he breaks these things down sounds exactly like a Jack Kirby comic. It's what I think of the whole time when he's explaining about, the idea that the fundamental or the foundation of the universe is mental and is consciousness and metaconsciousness, and that they're the questions, not material questions, not physicalist questions. It all just sounds like Jack Kirby. It's just so funny because I just think about it and I'm like, oh, these dudes. And I had the pleasure of talking to Dr. Jeff Kripal the other day, and he said it in our conversation. He's like, for someone like me who comes from the academic side of things, when I read Kirby, I'm like, oh, he's getting it. He's just not formally educated in these things. He's tapping into these things, even though they're worded differently than an academic or someone that's versed in those things would word them, but he's saying the same things. And I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what I've been getting.
It's a very similar concept to what I came to in the past season of my show, is that everything is a story.
Yeah.
Everything. Yeah. Once something happens, it's done. That's anything right. After that point is just a story based on that event.
Yes. Yes. That's so beautiful. No, I think you're absolutely right. And honestly, I think this is a really great note to start wrapping things up on, because I would, one, love to hear you expand a little bit about that and the last season that you did and what led you to that conclusion. Because it's something that obviously I've said a lot on this podcast, and have really that concept that we are either living in a giant artwork, or that we are part of a giant story, or that like everything is built of mythology and these global narratives that keep popping up. I would love to hear your thoughts on those and how you kind of came to that conclusion via your wonderful show, The Esoteric Book Club.
So very similar to what I was saying about all artwork. It's symbolic. Well, we have the same symbols in our language and how we convey messages. But even language is an art form. So there's good writers and there's bad writers. And it's more how artfully they convey the message and how people can understand the message, which really determines that. But there's also the stories that we tell, our oral traditions. So like witness accounts of UFOs, Bigfoot sightings, cryptid encounters. When you record that, I don't want to say it influences reality, but it is reality because that's how it was experienced by that person.
Yep.
For that person, it was real. Whether you choose to believe it or not is on you. But it had such an impact on this individual that it is reshaping their entire world.
Absolutely.
And then I ran into several books that influenced me. I'm blanking on the name of it. Passport to Magonia is the one that really kicked this off. And then I started running into other creators like Zelia Edgar, mm-hmm. who really just, she recounts the story as it was told. She leaves all the details in there for everyone to experience it as the witness experienced it. And I think that is very important, because if you start leaving out details, you lose a lot of the context.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So then you also have, say, casebook files such as Secret Invasion, the Chestnut Ridge encounters. You need all that weirdness in there, because you lose context if you don't have it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then what really got me is a book that came out in October, and it is now the number one book that I recommend to anybody who wants to delve into this. It's the book Ancestral Whispers by Ben Stimson.
Okay.
Now, the book is about ancestor veneration, but the most important part of that book is defining what an ancestor is, because so many people in modern American society, our immediate knee-jerk reaction is, oh, it's blood relatives. Well, okay, what if you're adopted?
Yeah.
Who has a bigger influence on who you are today? The person who birthed you or the person who raised you?
Absolutely.
Well, if we're going into who influenced you, does your family pet count as an ancestor when they pass along? They had an influence on you for a dozen years. That should count.
Absolutely.
Well, what about these fictional characters? Superman is the greatest example. He is a moral guidepost for so many people. For over 100 years at this point. He's fictional, but he has such detail added to him, and he's been so influential on so many people, he could be an ancestor in the same way that the Romans saw Hercules as an ancestor for certain individuals.
That's gorgeous. Oh my gosh, I got to read this book. This is
beautiful. It's a fantastic book. It's such an easy read. And when I did the review on this book, I came up with a phrase for it saying that Ben has a good economy of words. He can convey a message so clearly and so concisely that you don't have to sit there and reread it over and over and over again to understand the concept.
That's beautiful.
You read it and you get it.
Yeah. That can be rare. That can be rare. That's a very fine talent. I got to check that out. That's so in line with a bunch of my favorite thinking of this stuff. Like Grant Morrison's Super Gods talks very similarly about Superman, and also the way that we can use it. Like, some days you have to be Batman and you have to be a detective, and some days you have to be Superman. You have to be this, you know, empathetic immigrant from another world that's surrounded in all of this sea of differentness, and you have to utilize, almost like Robert Anton Wilson would talk about reality tunnels, why limit that to just flesh and human beings? Like, use the fictional characters in the same way, see the world as if you were the Martian Manhunter, or as if you were, you know, all these different things. And I had never thought about that ancestrally, like, you can choose your own ancestors and, you know, put them on the altar. And, like, you know, I think that's really beautiful, because I have one of the things that's always resonated with me with people like a Ram Dass, or these people that kind of integrate pop culture and this kind of, you know, more spiritual side of things, and, you know, is not afraid to have a Spider-Man on his altar next to the very holy figures and such. So I love that. I'm going to have to check that out. Man, this is beautiful. Well,
they're all archetypes.
Yes, absolutely.
Every single one, even people that actually existed, living family member or no longer living family members if they're on the ancestral altar. But, you know, you're not seeing them in their entirety. Yeah. When they are there and being venerated, they are taking the role of an archetype. That's it's so just true. A little bit more complicated, because you knew that person and you know what their archetype represents.
Wow. And that probably makes it a more effective interaction with that archetype, like having that kind of intimate relationship with it, whether it is a family member or a piece of fiction that got you through a really hard time, or you have this intimate connection with that archetype that probably enhances the practical usefulness of it, if that makes sense. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. I love it. All right, well, Jason, this was so good. I had no clue. Like, you know, comics are wonderful in so many ways, but especially in the way of getting to talk about weird stuff. And I'm really glad that we ended there, because that's it's so useful. Like, that is practical things that you can, like, apply and make your life a little better, or at least a little bit more enchanted and, like, you know, change up the normal day-to-day kind of mundane thoughts, which is very hard to do sometimes. So thank you so much for coming on and having this conversation, and I am real stoked to share this and more. So please tell people where to find your wonderful podcast and anything else that you want to share with everybody.
You can find my podcast, The Esoteric Book Club, on literally any podcasting app at this point. You can't miss it. It's got an open book. There's a green neon ghost on one side and a purple tentacle on the other.
It's very
really stands out. And I mean, if you like the show, primarily just share it with people. But you can also join my Patreon, which is patreon.com/esoteric book club.
Wonderful. Thank you again, Jason. We'll do this again very soon, I'm sure. I think one of the things I'm going to do next is start. I have a few more one-on-one episodes with some folks about comics, and then I want to set up a few roundtables, because it's been a minute since I've had a group discussion about anything, and I think this might be a good instance to get a couple friends together.
Absolutely.
Totally. All right, well, enjoy the rest of your day. I'll talk to you soon.
See ya. Bye.